This is Fresh Air. Travel writer Paul Theroux was working on a novel when his marriage fell apart. Then his state of mind became even more miserable when he went for a physical and found out he might have skin cancer. He needed to get away, so he left England and went to his parents' home in Boston, but even that depressed him. When a call came inviting him to do a book tour through Australia and New Zealand, he said yes, that would get him far away. And when the book tour ended, he continued his journey. For the next 18 months, with a tent, sleeping bag, and collapsible kayak, he traveled across 51 islands in the Pacific, including Tahiti, Samoa, the Solomons, Tonga, and the Hawaiian Islands. He tells the story of his voyage in his new book, The Happy Isles of Oceania, Paddling the Pacific. Theroux is well known for his previous books, The Great Railway Bazaar, The Old Patagonian Express, and his novel, The Mosquito Coast. By the way, his biopsy was negative. You know, even when Theroux was married, he traveled alone. I asked him what the difference was between traveling alone, knowing you have a family waiting for you at home, and traveling alone without a wife to come home to.
When you're alone and you, I suppose in a mood of separation, you really, you think, anything I might do might be a decision for life. I might never go back. You're not thinking, at the end of this trip, I'm going to go back home and write a book. I'm going to go back and tell someone the story. I have a home to go back to. I'm missed. You don't think, someone's missing me. No one was missing me. Now, I'm saying that, I'm not saying that looking for self-pity, but if you're missed, there's a kind of strength about it, but you're given strength by other people. And it could be a wife, a husband, a spouse, children, whoever. But if you're not missed, you might as well disappear. You could just drown, die, disappear, whatever. And the thought of that, the thought of sort of just vanishing furiously into nothingness, it worried me a lot. It gave me a lot of anxiety. But then it made me think, well, I have to be strong. I have to do something. I have to make something of this. I can't, you know, self-pity doesn't really get you anywhere. I think one of the difficult things about traveling in the Pacific, because I went to every Pacific island I could possibly go in this mood, is that people are constantly asking you, where's your wife? Where's your family? Where's your children? Why did you leave them behind? You mean you're alone? Because the concept of loneliness, of being alone, is unknown in the Pacific. There are people who live in groups, travel in groups, have big families, and possess big islands.
Did that make you feel very depressed about yourself, or did you just feel, well, look, our culture's different, and I like being alone?
I wasn't too sure how much I liked being alone, but did it make me feel depressed? It made me feel that I had to explain. And you don't really want to explain, but of course I did in the best way I could. And sometimes I lied to them. I said, "Oh well, they're not here at the moment, but maybe they'll meet me, or maybe they'll come." You sort of invent things. That's sort of depressing, inventing things. No, I mean, I think that most of the time I was in a fairly good mood, or at least I think my mood lightened.
So for this trip, you decided to take a collapsible kayak and paddle to different islands in Oceania. Do you need a hook like that when you start a journey?
It wasn't so much a hook as a sort of convenient way of getting from place to place. I'll tell you what I hate, and that's flying to a place like Papeete or Guadalcanal or Port Moresby or wherever, and having to be at the mercy of someone's bus or another plane or something. I'm sure everyone's had the experience of arriving in a really nice place and walking down to a beach and saying, there's a little headland, there's a little island. How do you, you know, I'd like to have a boat, I'd like to paddle, I'd like to just get off this island and look back. To have a mode of transportation that's your own. And being self-sufficient was very, very important to me. Maybe it was important. I mean, I hadn't thought of this before, but maybe that kind of self-sufficiency was very important because I had left home, because my wife and I had separated. Maybe I needed to be very self-sufficient. But I do remember getting to a place and someone saying, oh, you're not going to have any luck in the Trobriand Islands. There's nowhere to stay there, and there's a lot of mosquitoes. And I said, I have a tent, I have a sleeping bag, I have a mosquito netting and a stove and a boat and a paddle and a life jacket. All I need is some food. And there's, you know, if there's people there, there's food there. So I'll buy some food or get some food, and I'm okay. I got off the plane. I did find a place to stay, but I went to some islands and paddled, put up a tent, and slept there. And I did that all over the Pacific, including Easter Island, and it seemed to answer all the problems that I imagined.
You've called your book The Happy Isles of Oceania, and you know, in popular culture, when you're creating a paradise, it's often the South Pacific. You know, it's the setting of South Pacific, the musical. It's Tahiti and Mutiny on the Bounty, where the mutineers briefly live in paradise before the rest of the story gets on. Did it seem like a paradise to you?
Some of the islands did seem like paradise, although there's always a snake in paradise, isn't there? I mean, isn't the archetype? You're not going to find a place that is just bliss from beginning to end. But I found lots of places, particularly places where people were self-sufficient. They had plenty of food. They were healthy. There weren't Japanese building golf courses. In the Solomons, in Vanuatu, parts of Tonga, in the Cook Islands, even to a certain extent in Hawaii, although Hawaii is a highly civilized place, there are little corners where you say, God, this is the most beautiful place I've ever seen in my life. What is there anything wrong? And you find, no, there isn't. I mean, everything's fine, except that you might not belong there. I mean, it really is someone else's island.
Travel writer and novelist Paul Theroux is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Paul Theroux is my guest. His new book is called The Happy Isles of Oceania, Paddling the Pacific. You describe the Hawaiian Islands as being the most remote islands in the world, more distant from a mainland than any other islands. Do you feel that remoteness anymore now that Hawaii has been more built up?
Yes and no. Hawaii has been built up, and people go there and they say, oh, Hawaii, Waikiki, bits of madhouse, Japanese tourists. But I can tell you that I got to parts of Hawaii that can't have changed very much since Captain Cook was there, or at least they certainly didn't look it. I mean, the interior of the islands, or the somewhat inaccessible coast. I paddled a kayak to a lot of coves, a lot of bays, a lot of headlands that don't have roads to them. Hikers get there, or canoeists get there. But I thought that they were amazingly interesting and in having great natural beauty and no population. I mean, there are completely uninhabited parts of Hawaii. There are islands, you know, the Hawaiian chain is quite big. There are uninhabited small atolls in the Hawaiian chain, too.
One of the things that you did in Hawaii is that you stayed in a luxury bungalow that costs $2,500 a day, continental breakfast included.
Yeah.
What came over you?
I was asked to stay in an expensive place to write a story. And, I mean, it cost $2,500 a night. I stayed two nights. I mean, you just say it was not my $5,000. It was the publication that paid for it. But they did pay. But I said, hey, I'll do that on one condition, that I stay on the same coast but sleep in a tent and live for $2.50 a day. And so that seemed like a good idea, doing both the rough and the smooth. And to tell you the truth, I mean, staying in a tent under a palm tree is just as much fun as spending $2,500 and having a butler. As a matter of fact, you have slightly more freedom in a tent, and it's the same sky, it's the same beach. In Hawaii, all the beaches are public. No one can be kicked off a beach. The most expensive house, beach house, has to share the beach with anyone who cares to swim there. That's not true of Cape Cod. It's not true of, you know, Martha's Vineyard. Not true of a lot of parts of the USA. But it is true of Hawaii. And I should say that just added to this, the pleasure of sleeping in a tent as opposed to the luxury bungalow at the Monolani Resort was that I saw a humpback whale. Well, anyone on the beach would have seen that humpback whale broaching in the water. I saw later that week molten lava pouring into the sea. And then a little while after, there was a total eclipse of the sun on that same island, on the big island of Hawaii, and a beautiful sunrise over a volcanic crater. Among the most beautiful things that I've seen in my life, and they didn't cost anything, you know.
The end of your book was written in Hawaii in January of 92, and you seem to be having a very hard time ending the trip with no wife or home to come home to, or at least not the same home, or not both of the same homes anyways, because you had a home in England and a home on Cape Cod.
Yes.
So how did you decide? I assume that you've ended the trip. I mean, that you're not going back to Hawaii when the book tour is over.
Well, I may be. Who knows? I developed friendships there, and I was very happy there. And realizing that Hawaii is the 50th state, I mean, this is the United States. It's not a million miles away. It's a very, very pleasant place, and it's a place I could well imagine not being, Robert Louis Stevenson living in Hawaii and writing books there. It's a wonderful place for writing. As far as settling there, who knows? I mean, anything could happen. I was very happy there.
What kept you happy there?
I suppose friendships. First, the natural beauty, but also meeting people, making friends. And that really is what life is about. For a writer who is often in a state of permanent alienation or feeling that way, making a friend is a very important thing. And it's the thing that you realize that you're writing for. You can't really write for yourself. Other people are involved in your life and your work, as well as, living in a lovely place. So it was very inspiring, I should say.
So where are you living now?
Well, I live sort of off and on the Cape. I have been going back and forth to Hawaii since I finished the book. And as this is the summer, I'm on the Cape working on a novel and feeling good about it, feeling optimistic.
When you go back to Hawaii now to stay for, I don't know how long you stay, you're not a tourist, but you're also not a travel writer writing a book about the trip. So where do you stay?
Well, it depends. I mean, I have actually been sharing a house with a woman there. Is this what you're leading up to?
No.
I have been sharing a house with a woman, and so I wouldn't say that I'm a tourist. I would say that one of the curious things about Hawaii is that if you're not a tourist, you realize that the city has the city of Honolulu, anyway, has a life of its own, that tourism occupies a mile of seafront at Waikiki, and that it's Main Street USA in Polynesia.
You are what, in your 40s, right?
No, I'm 51 years old.
Oh, okay.
I don't feel it, though. I think I feel sort of the way I know. When I was in my 30s, I felt in my 40s. And now that I'm in my, am I in my early 50s? At 51, I suppose I am. I feel probably as though I feel sort of physically 30s, yeah.
So it's still comfortable for you to camp out in the way you were doing on this trip?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do feel physically fit, and I must say that a sort of trip like this, I came back much healthier, physically healthier, mentally healthier than when I set out. It's something. Well, I mean, when I was in my late 30s, all my habits changed. I stopped smoking, I stopped drinking, and I stopped eating meat, all meat. And I just thought, I think I'll live longer. I think I'll live better. So I began to take up various solitary sports like biking and paddling. And so that's what, for about the past 10 or 11 years, I've been paddling. It's also a great antidote to writing. I really, much as I like writing, I hate sitting in a room on a sunny day working. And I don't do it anymore. I used to, when I was younger, I used to sit there and slog away. Now, when the sun comes out, I leave and I go do something, go for a walk, go bird watching, go paddling, or see friends. You know, I do something I loaf and invite my soul, let's say.
You better not move to Los Angeles. You'll never write another word again. If you're waiting for the rain.
No, that's a smoggy place. It's not so much the rain. It's, I lived in England for 17 years, and I found it was a wonderful place to work because I never felt like going out much. It's a very indoor society. Outdoor societies may not be great for writing, but they're good for living. And living is something, I suppose, is something that I was doing in the Pacific, living. And when you look back on living, you have something to write.
Do you miss England?
I don't. I miss the friends that I have there, but the place itself seems, it just seems like a school that I was in. It's like that's the impression, a place that I graduated from. I always used to think, when I was flying into England, I better wipe this smile off my face. I'm going to be landing soon.
What made you feel that way?
I felt a kind of sternness in the society, and I felt that I didn't belong. England is a very tolerant society. Everyone is allowed to live there, but no one's allowed to join. London is a cosmopolitan place, so it doesn't necessarily apply there. But I've lived all over England in villages and have traveled there. And the sense of alienation that anyone feels there is very, very strong. I used to have very, very strong homing instincts almost from the first moment, because when you're in a place and you feel that you're tolerated but that you can't join, you can't integrate, you think, well, I need a place to go back to. So the first thing I did on having this sense in England was to buy a house in the States. And I, for a long, long time, I didn't live in the house, but I thought, well, that's a place I can go back to.
That was your house in Cape Cod?
Yes.
And now you're actually living there?
Yes, I am. So I guess I was, in the way that often in a novel, you introduce a character and you don't know what's going to happen to this character, but later that character becomes very, very important. I suppose that happened to me. But I needed a place to retreat to.
Well, Paul Theroux, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure, Terry.
Paul Theroux's new book, The Happy Isles of Oceania, is published by Putnam.